जय ओम विष्णुपाम सबदनाजिकचायस्तु ते सतशिशिमर एसी भक्ति वेदांत स्वामी महाराज श्री प्रभुपाद की जय ओम विष्णुपाम सबदनाजिकचाय अस्तु ते सतशिशिमर भक्ति सिद्धांत सरस्वती ठाकुर प्रभुपाद की अनंत कोटि वैष्णविंद की इस्कॉन फाउंडर चार्ज श्री प्रभुपाद की नामाचार्य श्री हरिदास ठाकुर की प्रेम से कहो श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानंद श्री अद्वैत Radha, Shivasadi Go, Bhakta Vrindaki, Shri Shri Radha, Krishna, Gopagopinath, Shyamakun, Radhakun, Giri Govardhan Ki, Vrindavan Dham Ki, Navadvip Dham Ki, Ganga Mai Ki, Yamuna Mai Ki, Tulasi Devi Ki, Bhakti Devi Ki, Samaveta Bhakta Vrindaki, Gaura Premanandi. All glories to assembled devotees. All glories to assembled devotees. All glories to assembled devotees. All glories to Sisi Guru Gauranga. Marigolds and me don't get along. Thank you. Is there any verse anywhere, or I just read it? Okay. Text 3, yes. Begins with Prabhuta. Okay. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Srimad Bhagavatam, 5th Canto, Chapter 13. Rahugana converses with Jadabharata. Prabhuta virut trinagoma gafare. Katoradam shayama shakai upadruta. Kwachchit tu gandharva purang prapashyati. Kwachich kwachich chashu rayo mukha graham. Prabhuta virut trinagoma gafare. Katoda dam shire masakau padruta. Kwachit tu gandharva. Puram prapashyati. Kwachit, kwachit, chashu, rayo mukha graham. Thank you. Vaishnavis. Prabhuta, a very large number. Virut, of creepers. Trina, of varieties of grass. Goma, of thickets. Gavare, in bowers. Katora, cruel. Dangshai, by bites. Mushakai, by mosquitoes. Upadruta, disturbed. Kwachit, sometimes. Two, but. Gandhavapuram, a false palace created by the Gandharvas. Prapashyati, he sees. Kwachit, and sometimes. Kwachit, sometimes. Cha, and. Ashuraya, very quickly. Omuka, like a meteor. Graham, a fiend. Translation. In this forest, there are dense bowers composed of thickets of bushes, grass, and creepers. In these bowers, the conditioned soul is always disturbed by cruelly biting mosquitoes, envious people. Sometimes he sees an imaginary palace in the forest, and sometimes he is bewildered by seeing a fleeting fiend or ghost which appears like a meteor in the sky. Purport. The material household is actually a whole of fruitive activity. To earn a livelihood, one engages in different industries and trades, and sometimes one performs great sacrifices to go to the higher planetary systems. Apart from this, at least everyone is engaged in earning a livelihood in some profession or occupation. In these dealings, one has to meet many undesirable people, and their behavior is compared to the biting of mosquitoes. This creates very undesirable conditions. Even in the midst of these disturbances, one imagines that he's going to construct a grand house and live there permanently, although he knows that he cannot. Gold is compared to a quickly fleeting fiend, which appears like a meteor in the sky. It displays itself for a moment and is then gone. Generally, karmis are attracted to gold or money, but these are compared herein to ghosts and witches. Om Ajnanachimirandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshunmilitang Yena Tasmai Shri Guruve Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shri Vasudevi Gaura Bhaktavrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. We are in the midst of Jug Bharat's mercy on Rahugana Maharaj. That mercy is going to take the form of elaboration on very concise instructions that Jug Bharat has already given. He's going to have two goes at the elaboration. There's this chapter, and then in the next chapter he's going to expand upon and deepen upon what he's already elaborated on in this chapter. So this is the mercy of the Bhagavatam. The Bhagavatam is no airy-fairy shastra. It is very pragmatic also. In its portrayal, presentation of love of Krishna. And we bear in mind that Sanatan Goswami says in Krishna Lila Stava that every syllable of Srimad Bhagavatam is saturated with Krishna Prema. So sometimes we think that such and such part of the Bhagavatam is not relishable, or such and such part of the Bhagavatam is not nectarian. But as we advance in spiritual life, we move closer to what Sanatan Goswami is saying. How, indeed, every syllable can be saturated with Krishna praying. Every syllable is saturated, but our perception needs to become purified. So, in presenting that Krishna praying to us, Bhagavatam is very pragmatic. It's realistic. How so? It's taking into account how impenetrable is the illusion that we live in. Now, just consider Rahugana Maharaj. He was a Vedic king. He was not totally ignorant of the science of the soul, of what is punya, what is papa. He understood simple activities, good karmic activities, pious activities. Yet and still, Jug Bharat is going through and will go through such an endeavor to present the nature of the material illusion to the king. The king has already been astonished by Jug Bharat's preliminary salvos, you might say. And the king was so astonished that he jumped down from his palanquin and paid full dandavats, begging forgiveness for his sarcasm in terms of his criticizing Jud Bharat for the way Jud Bharat was carrying the palanquin, trying to avoid the ants, and then that would make the palanquin jerk. Remember, Rahugana Maharaj and his bosses had recruited this Paramahansa sage, Jud Bharat, into ordinary physical labor. They conscripted him. They drafted him. And now, the king is finding out, what is the quality of this person who I thought was a brute? He's speaking such concise, potent instructions. So just by hearing those first sutra-like instructions, the king dives off of his palanquin onto the ground, offering full obeisances. Because of his presenting himself in that way, he's able to receive the mercy of Jud Bharat in the form of elaborative spiritual instructions. So those instructions come via a vehicle. That vehicle is this allegory of the forest of material enjoyment. And Jud Bharat is going to really work on that allegory. He's going to enunciate it. He's going to expand it for our benefit. In this way, an intelligent person can understand how tricky is the illusion. As Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, Daivyesha gunamai mama maya dravya. Krishna himself is describing the power of his illusory energy, and he's warning us, you can't see your way through it on your own. It's too much. You can't outsmart it. You can't. Your financial power will not help. Your personal abilities will not help. There's only one way you can cope, and that is mam eva ye prapajyante mayam etam tarantite. Only by doing things my way can you escape this illusion, can you emerge from this illusion. So Jud Bharat is going to illustrate various aspects of the illusion by this allegory of the forest. You can recall that earlier in the fourth canto, Narada Muni, in speaking to King Prachinabarhisa, explained the allegory of Paranjan. So the Bhagavatam makes most potent use of allegorical devices, because sometimes people don't want to take things straight on. But does that mean the Bhagavatam will not deliver the absolute truth? No. It will deliver the absolute truth in a vehicle that will get past person's defenses. So who wouldn't like to hear about a forest? And walking in the forest. It's like, yeah, Vaisheshika Prabhu here. Sometimes he goes for walks in the California redwood forest. It's nice. Yet, what's actually going on in the forest? Any biologist, any botanist will tell you the forest is a place of fierce struggle for existence. But you don't think that when you're walking in a nice forest, as long as you feel relatively safe and secure, you think, no, how pleasant, how peaceful, how rejuvenating. Meanwhile, all around you, under you, and above you is going on such a fierce struggle. One life is feeding on another life. Similarly, material existence to the fool seems to be an inviting place. This is Judd Barrett's point. Just like a merchant enters into the forest seeking natural resources for profit. Herbs or jewels or gold or whatever he expects to find in a forest. Of course, the modern equivalent of that is plundering the world for oil, for uranium, for titanium, strategic metals. Same principle. You see the world as your place for profiting. So this motive of entering into the forest of material enjoyment for the sake of profit, for the sake of personal aggrandizement, personal advancement, this is what Judd Barrett is going to attack by speaking very beautifully about the forest of material enjoyment. It seems so innocent. Why should I not enjoy the forest? Similarly, why should I not enjoy the material world? People often say that if there's a God, didn't he give us these bodies to enjoy? God gives everything. So we have these bodies, we should enjoy it. It seems automatic, it seems natural. And then, when there's a problem, as there must be in their material life, they deny the existence of God. They say, how can there be a God? The classic problem of evil, philosophers call it. How can there be a God who allows such horrors and calamities and catastrophes to go on in this world? So what they're doing when they say that, actually, is they're asserting the existence of God. They're saying, there's a God that doesn't meet my standard. Therefore, there's no God. In other words, if you say, how can there be a God who allows the Holocaust or this pandemic or whatever? You are having in mind a standard for how God should behave. So you can't have your cake and eat it at the same time. If there's no God, then don't worry about it. Just suffer. Leave it at that. You can't make a theology saying, if there is a God, he wouldn't behave in this way. How dare you have a standard about God when God doesn't exist? So just shut up. It takes a long time for us to come to the point of understanding this material world is not meant for our enjoyment. Enjoying in this world seems so natural, doesn't it? What makes it seem so natural? That is Krishna's illusory energy. And that is what Krishna is warning us about in Bhagavad Gita. It may feel natural, but you should understand it's all artificial. Now, how long is it going to take for us to understand that? We're being deceived. How has this deception come about? Karanam gunasangasa sadasa joni janmasu. Due to simply our contact with material nature, we become deceived. In other words, and this is a fundamental point for dealing with the forest of material existence, the fundamental point is that there's nothing innocent about associating with material nature. It's a hard point for us to accept. Because our conditioned nature, which we identify with as the self, thinks that I'm just wandering through this world, I'm wandering through the forest, seeking pleasurable experiences, I don't mean to hurt anyone, I'm looking for personal fulfillment, and if I have the chance, I'll help anyone else in their personal fulfillment, and you don't bother me, I don't bother you, and what's wrong with a life like that? So we assume innocence, just like you know. We assume that children are innocent. We don't understand their karmic background from previous lifetimes. So we have this false vision of our innocently meandering through the material world. And then something happens and we're shocked. What kind of world is this? What kind of God is in charge? Where is the justice? Where is the happiness? It takes knowledge to understand that by associating with material nature, guna sangha, you pick up contaminations. Would you just go wandering happily and peacefully through a part of the world, let's say West Africa, where the pandemic is? Oh, well, I'm just going to wander through, what is it, Liberia or Sierra Leone. What? You say, I've got this fatal disease? How could that be possible? I'm me. I have my program. What is the difficulty? By hearing Judd Barrett's explanation, you will lose that naivete. More than naivete about wandering through material existence innocently. It's more than naivete. It is avijja, ignorance. What does Queen Kunti, the most liberated woman, explain in the first canto? Bhaveshmen krishyamananam avijja kama kama bi. You are pushed into fruit of activity, into karmic activity, by the nescience potency of the Lord. And therefore you become implicated in trying to fulfill so many desires. You have to work so hard for the sake of that innocent plan for enjoyment. So these chapters, this one, the next one, are going to strip away from you your comfort zone in a very poetic way. Just like today we're hearing. In this forest, there are dense bowers composed of thickets of bushes, grass, and creepers. You think, oh, that's nice. Vegetation, shade, nice scenery. In these bowers, the conditioned soul is always disturbed by cruelly biting mosquitoes. Well, no one likes mosquitoes. I remember I was once a camp counselor in Michigan as a summer job. And so it was a camp run by the public school system. So the public school system sent up their nature expert to take all the kids on a nature tour in the forest. And so the counselors also had to go to watch over the kids while the nature expert was pointing out different things in the forest. So the forest was full of mosquitoes, and the counselors and the kids hated it. These mosquitoes. But we looked at the nature expert, and we saw an amazing thing. He would not swat any mosquitoes. And so finally everyone asked him, hey, how come you're not swatting the mosquitoes? They're landing on you. They're biting you. Why don't you do something? Do you have some secret repellent or what? What's going on? And he said, let me educate you. These mosquitoes, if you let them bite, first they inject the substance that makes you itch, and then they withdraw it. So you just let them go on with their bite, and in that way, they'll complete their job. They'll withdraw the itchy stuff, and you won't be bothered. No one could accept that. I'm not letting any mosquitoes bite. As soon as they land on me, I'm going to smash them. So you can just see the scene in the forest. All these kids are just... their whole peaceful excursion in the forest destroyed. And the expert, the one who had knowledge, is totally peaceful and undisturbed. Now, I don't know about the mosquitoes in India, whether they behave in that way. Anyway, these were Michigan mosquitoes. So evidently, the scientific reality about the Michigan mosquitoes is they inject an itchy stuff when they first bite, and then if you just let them be, they'll take your blood, and they'll also withdraw the itchy stuff. So even though the nature expert explained it, he's the guru of the... he's explaining, don't worry about the mosquitoes. The imperfect, uncontrolled senses of the kids couldn't handle that. They were just overwhelmed by the superficial reality of the experience. Eek! A mosquito landing on me, taking my blood. No way. So even though he's explaining, look, just wait. You won't itch. You can just peacefully go about your way in the forest, learning about nature, and you don't have to constantly be in anxiety, be agitated, swatting mosquitoes. Just wait. Let them have their quota. You won't itch. Of course, in that particular forest, there was no danger of malaria or anything like that. So, in any case, the point is, he was giving knowledge, but that knowledge ran up against the barrier of the kids' uncontrolled senses. So even though he's telling them the reality, they could not accept it. It didn't make sense to them. Because they, in the bodily conception of life, they're thinking, no way a mosquito's landing on me and taking my blood. They don't understand that their body is part of material nature. So even though they're hearing, they can't focus and apply what they've heard. So this is to demonstrate why Judd Barrett is being so elaborative. He's going to go over these examples again and deepen them in the next chapter. Because the reality is so stunning. You mean I am being deceived? Innocent me, good-hearted me. I'm not the best person. I'm not the worst person. I'm just trying to make my way through this world without hurting people. Just trying to get my due, my share of material happiness. And you mean to tell me it's all an illusion? That's too much. I can't accept that. Even our own devotees often have problems accepting what Krishna is saying in Bhagavad Gita straight on. How can it be that I am wholly immersed in illusion and my only reality, my only contact reality is through devotional service? So if you read, for example, one purport where Srila Prabhupada says, other than devotional service to Krishna, every other endeavor is illusion. It's just too straight on, right? Yeah, it's just too much. In fact, these days you may be considered to be fanatical. Outside of devotional service, every other human endeavor is illusion. There's something in us that rebels against that. Alright, devotional service is good, it's nice, but there are also other things that one needs to do in a well-rounded life. A well-rounded life includes bhakti activities, no doubt about that, but also a good share of temporary activities just to round things out, you see? Because unless you're rounded out with nice temporary activities, you may just run the danger of being too spiritual. And remember, in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna warns about your being too spiritual. You've seen that verse, right? Yes? How many of you remember that verse in chapter 19? Where Krishna warns, watch out, you could be in danger of too much Krishna. Yes, some of our own devotees, they worry about that. Too much Krishna. No such thing, of course. Just like when Krishna says, Mataplataram nanyat kinchit asti janandaya. There's nothing superior to me. Nothing means there's nothing beyond Krishna. When you say the words beyond Krishna, you're speaking gibberish. You can put the two words together, speaking English, for example, beyond Krishna, but actually the phrase makes no sense. But in illusion, we think that there's meaning to that. Oh, beyond Krishna. Yeah. But the whole point of Bhagavad Gita and Bhagavatam is to teach you that there's nothing beyond Krishna. When he says, Mata Pratram Nanya Kinshita Asti Dhananjaya, he means nothing. That means not even Vishnu or Narayan. What to speak of the impersonal Brahman. So because these truths hit us so powerfully and concisely, therefore the acharyas, the Bhagavatam personalities, patiently speak in terms of allegories, patiently explain. Sometimes I even hear devotees say, you know, Prabhupada's books are nice, but the purports can be a bit repetitive. Well, if you know anything about teaching, even in the ordinary sense, you know that repetition is essential. Why do Prabhupada's books and the purports repeat the same things? Because guess what? We don't get it. The teacher understands the capacity of the student. So therefore, purport after purport, Prabhupada weaves the same themes while revealing his ecstasies or while making incisive comments about the material world, incisive comments about Goloka Vrindavan. While he's doing that, he's weaving the same points again and again. So someone may think, oh, we're beyond that. But are you sure? Better to think there's a reason why Prabhupada's purports bring up the same points again and again. And of course, it is not that Prabhupada's purports are simply focused on the basics of spiritual life. No, he's like a piano player who plays every key on the piano from that end to that end. Inconceivable genius. He doesn't just stay at the low end, dealing with lust, anger, greed, madness, envy, illusion. He doesn't simply stay on the high end, dealing with Radha Krishna Leela and Goloka Vrindavan. He goes back and forth from one end to the other. This is a sign of a genius that's out of this world. When I first encountered Prabhupada's books, I had already studied at the best institutions in the world. I learned under the most erudite professors, topmost in their field. Not the ones who repeat what others say, but the ones who write the books that everyone else at the other schools has to study. So I studied under these persons. And I knew that they didn't know what they're talking about. Even before I picked up Prabhupada's books. But once I started reading Prabhupada's books, I could recognize this is true genius. Not simply from my spiritual intuition, not simply from any bhakti tendencies I might have had well hidden at the time, but just from a viewpoint of comparing how intelligence works. So I was just shocked at how someone could just cover the whole panorama and jump back and forth like that. One minute he's talking about envy, The next minute he's talking about Radha and Krishna and the bowers of Vrindavan. I said, what kind of genius is this? I remember in Los Angeles, Prabhupada explaining about his books. He said that his books are like a pharmacy, or in some countries they're called the chemist, place where you go to get prescriptions. A drugstore also, they're called. My books are like a pharmacy. They have medicines for all levels of patients. There are things there for the neophyte to the most advanced devotee. So this is the mercy of the parampara. And Judd Barrett is conveying that kind of mercy to Rahugana Maharaj, because we're dealing with something that is difficult to accept fully upon first hearing. And even if you think that, oh yeah, I accept that, you actually don't fully understand the extent of the illusion that's enveloping us. When Krishna says this illusory energy of his is so impossible to overcome, it takes a while for that comprehension to sink in. That's why Prabhupada once said that, very charitably, he said, there's only one difference between my disciples and me. He's very charitably speaking. My disciples have no fear of Maya, and I am always praying to Krishna, please don't let me fall down. That's the only difference. Now just think about that. How is it that we have no fear of Maya? In other words, we don't fully feel the impact of being in such a dangerous place. And that's why Judd Barrett is going to make such an effort in several chapters. By the time he finishes, he's going to go through three chapters of elaboration, explanation to Rahugana Maharaj. So how deep this illusion is that we've wandered into, it takes a while. It takes some advancement in bhakti to fully appreciate. This is why the acharyas say bhakti goes on two rails, jnana and vairagya, knowledge and detachment. The more you know, the more detached you'll become. The more detached you become, the more you'll be able to know. Wandering through material existence has a price. Sometimes people say that experience is the best teacher. But they forget the other half of that mantra. That mantra, experience is the best teacher, is actually an old English couplet. But the other half is totally forgotten. Experience is the best teacher because a fool will learn no other way. Now, how many of you ever heard the other half of that? No. That's the progress of the age of Kali. Even mundane sayings, which have some degree of wisdom in them, they're forgotten. So now we just hear, oh, experience is the best teacher, you know? You just got to do it and then you understand. No. Experience is the lousiest teacher because you will pay a price for that experience. It is not that the illusory energy is just going to say, come experience me and there'll be no cost. You'll learn your lesson, whatever that lesson is supposed to be, and there'll be no damage. That's the nature of my educational facility. You experience Maya and no side effects, no damage whatsoever. Forget it. You pay a heavy price. So that's why Krishna says, Daivyesha Gunamai. The price of that Daivi Maya, that illusory energy coming from Krishna, the price for interacting with it is too high. Krishna doesn't want you to learn by experience. The whole point of Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam is to learn by hearing. But in order to learn by hearing, one has to have some basic control of the mind and senses. By engaging in devotional service, you receive in exchange the clarity of consciousness to be able to hear with attention. Not only hear with attention, but to hear with taste, with ruchi. The first canto of Bhagavatam explains, Vasudeva Kata Ruchi San Mahat Sevaya Vipra. By rendering devotional service to the great souls, you get the ruchi, the taste for hearing Vasudeva Kata, the talks about the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So that is what brings experience without your being battered by hearing Srimad Bhagavatam. In the association of devotees, you actually gain experience in a constructive way, in a way that doesn't damage you. But the illusory energy pounds on our consciousness that, no, if you really want to understand, you've got to get out and do things. Have your senses interact with material nature. You'll experience happiness and distress, and by that interaction with Trigunamayi, the three modes of material nature, by your interaction with that, you'll learn, you'll get vidya, knowledge. No. Actually, by interacting with the illusory energy, you simply get illusion. But in the course, and this is what Krishna explains at the end of Bhagavad Gita, in the course of wandering through material existence trying to be happy, sometimes you reach the end of all those endeavors. Now, how is that? Is it the experience of material nature that sometimes leads you to the end of all materialistic endeavors for happiness? No. As Prabhupada explains in the purport, it is when you stumble upon a devotee. It is not the experience of material endeavors for happiness that sometimes brings you to the end of those endeavors. No, it is while you are stumbling around in the forest of material enjoyment, while you're being harassed by the mosquitoes, which are envious people, while you're hallucinating, thinking you're seeing an imaginary palace in the forest, while you're undergoing such suffering, sometimes you may stumble upon a devotee. And due to contact with the devotee, then you begin to think, there should be something else, there is something else. So it's not the experience that's generating that desire to exit the struggle in the forest. It is the contact with the devotee. And contact with the devotee is not part of the material experience. It is contact with a devotee is Krishna's insertion of mercy, apparently within material existence, but actually not related to material existence. So the divine arrangement is that throughout material existence, there are contact points with devotees, and that's what gives you your ticket out, not by so-called learning through experience. I guess I've got to learn some lessons. There's still some more lessons I have to learn. No. Where do you see in the Shastra that it's the job of the material energy to give you vidya, knowledge? Where do you see in the Shastra that it is the job of the material energy to truly educate you into how Maya works? That's not the job of Maya. The job of Maya is to bewilder you. So much so that even when you think you're getting a solution, you're getting more bewildered. So what brings us out of the forest of material enjoyment is not experience. What brings us out is if while traversing through that forest, we encounter a devotee, just like Rahugana Maharaj has encountered Judd Bharat. And Judd Barrett is imparting to him knowledge that is beyond material experience. That encounter with Judd Barrett is not a material phenomenon. And this is what Rahugana Maharaj so vividly understands. And therefore he plunges from his palanquin onto the ground after hearing the first set of instructions, the first comments, rather, from Judd Barrett. He realizes, I've made a huge mistake. I'm ignorant. Now please tell me more. So in this way, Judd Barrett is showing what is the real teacher and how you really learn. And Rahugana Maharaj will be so grateful that his life has taken such a turn. He was wandering through the forest of material enjoyment, thinking, I am the king, I'm the lord of all I survey, everyone should serve me. And suddenly his life went in a completely different direction. And in this way, by the mercy of Judd Barrett's allegory of the forest, Rahugana Maharaj is able to see clearly his mistake. His mistake is that he entered the forest of material enjoyment seeking a profit. There's nothing innocent about that. Our enjoying propensity is not innocent. It is a deadly affliction. And we get over this cancerous affliction by investing wholeheartedly in how to give Krishna enjoyment. In this way, our consciousness becomes clean and we can actually understand the transcendental reality. In that way, we can actually understand what is Vrindavan. Any questions or especially any comments from our senior Vaishnavas? Comment, yes.
I have a question, Maharaj. Thank you for your beautiful class, as usual. Can you explain the meaning of the verse 11, the mantra 11 in Sri Upanishad, vidyam cha yas tad vedo vayam saha? Only one who can learn the process of nations and that of transcendental knowledge side by side can transcend the influence of repeated birth and death and enjoy the full blessings of immortality.
Sure, I can explain that. It means in the morning we go to Bhagavatam class and at night we go to the movies. How can there be any doubt? haven't you heard? You're based in California. You know, it's part of the it's everywhere in the world, but you know, when you go to the movies, you can see Maya for what it is. You learn so much by, you know. And isn't that what the Isha Upanishad means? No. By hearing Bhagavatam, you learn what is nescience and what is real knowledge side by side. Because the Bhagavatam is presenting it all. It's explaining how the illusory energy works. This is giving you that full education. So the Isha Upanishad doesn't mean that, you know, half the day you hear about Krishna and the other half of the day you go into Maya because you want to, you know, experience both side by side and understand both side by side. No. Bhagavad Gita and Bhagavatam are teaching you all about what is nescience and what is reality side by side. The Vedic path means pravritti and nivritti. There are instructions if you want to enjoy the material world, how to do that. Nivritti, there are instructions for how to become detached from material existence. And of course, bhakti is beyond pravritti and nivritti. Bhakti, in its pure performance, is simply about what gives Krishna pleasure. So there's no need to engage in Maya in order to understand Maya. Where do you read that that's the job of Maya to teach you, by your interaction with her, how she functions? No. The more you engage in Maya, the more bewildered you become. And in fact, here's how it works. You think that you're coming up with a solution, a material solution. And as Prahlad Maharaj explains, the solution actually turns out to be worse than the original problem. I'll give an example. When you think of that verse in Bhagavad Gita where Krishna warns about demoniac behavior, they invent demoniac things that can destroy the whole world. So you think, oh, nuclear weapons, chemical weapons, biological weapons. I've got news for you. That's all outdated. Those fears are outdated. They're called NBC, nuclear, biological, chemical. No, the new thing now is nanotechnology, robotics, and genetics. Since at least the end of the 20th century, this is what is in the defense arsenal. Things that can make damage even more difficult to control than that done by nuclear, biological, and chemical weapons. But the average person doesn't know what's going on. So, you think you're going to solve this. We'll make a nuclear defense treaty, nuclear weapons treaty, stopping nuclear weapons proliferation. We'll make an agreement that there'll be no chemical weapons, no biological weapons. What they don't tell you is they've got worse in their arsenal. So where is the material solution? The so-called solution simply leads you deeper into illusion. So that's why Krishna, at the end of Bhagavad Gita, says, Sarvadaman Prachada, Mame Kam Sharanam Vaja. Just give up all your plans. Give up all your solutions. Take my solution. I hope that answers you. But you could comment, though.
I appreciated your answer. It obliterated any thought I had about going to the movies that night.
Hare Krishna Maharaj. The Purport also talks about the merchant trying to construct a home and earn gold. In the Purport, it says that he wants to construct a grand house and live there permanently, and he wants to earn gold. So we as grihasthas also want to construct our home and earn money. So how to understand these instructions in proper spirit?
The outstanding example is Bhaktivinoda Thakur, who in his songs he writes, I will certainly earn an income to support Krishna's family, and I will be like a dog guarding outside the door of the house of Krishna's family. So as I often explain in university lectures, because this question comes up, not exactly the way you say it, the question asked by non-devotees, they say, well, if we do what you say, no one will be working a job, no one will have families. So I explain the principle of going to work in order to give instead of to get. Go to work to give yourself a Krishna conscious lifestyle, to give it to your family, and give it to as many persons as your resources allow. That's a totally different motivation for going to work. The usual motivation for going to work is, I want money for me, for my material lifestyle, for my family's material lifestyle, and I'll do a little charity on the side. But the Vaishnav goes to work to give. And so in that way, your conscience is totally different. You want to give yourself a bhakti lifestyle. You want to give it to your family and as many others as you can. If you've got the resources, buy 500 sets of Prabhupada's books, put them in every library, whatever. If you got those kind of resources, that's what they're meant for. So go to work to give. That is performing your occupation for liberation.
Yes.
Thank you, Maharaj, for a wonderful class. As I understood, Maharaj, you have elaborately explained that the only means of getting out from entanglement of sense gratification is the causeless mercy of a devotee. But isn't it there a possibility of a living entity being out of being frustrated from not getting the happiness of sense gratification, getting into spiritual practices?
Material frustration will not lead you directly to bhakti. Material frustration can make you in a humble state of mind so that when you meet a devotee, you seize the opportunity. But in of itself, material frustration will not take you directly to bhakti. There must be the contact with devotees. That's what Judd Bard is explaining to Rahugan Maharaj. That famous verse, you know the verse, unless you are smear put upon your head the dust from... Unless you put upon your head the dust from a devotee, you're going nowhere. As Nectar Devotion explains, that simply material frustration in of itself could lead to your becoming, what's probably a communist or a drug addict or something like that. It'll just lead you to material solutions or material exasperation. Mm-hmm. Just like, for example, a Nobel Prize-winning philosopher said, there's only one essential question in life, whether to commit suicide or not. That's where material frustration will bring you. He won the Nobel Prize. All other questions are subordinate. The real question is, should you commit suicide or not, once you realize the futility of life? Or should you just accept that it's futile and just do everything your own way and just go out with style? I did it my way. It's all futile, it's all absurd, but I don't care. I did whatever I wanted to do, and now I'm extinct. So that's the only question. So frustration in of itself cannot directly lead you to bhakti. You must have contact with a devotee, and that's why we work so hard as devotees to make those contact points available for the people. That's their only hope. Even someone gives some slight assistance. Like sometimes I'm on the airplane and I have a bag in the overhead bins, and where the bag is far away from where I'm sitting, and so the plane lands, you know, everyone gets up to get out, they crowd the aisles, and I can't get to that bag, and then someone will see me looking down the plane at the overhead bin, and they'll, oh, your bag is there, okay, I'll get it for you, and they get the bag and they pass it down to the people to you. They have no idea that what they're doing. They're assisting someone who's trying to be a devotee. They have no idea. But the super soul notes, oh, you have assisted. So that's how it works. Therefore, we're such an outgoing Krishna conscious society, to give people somehow or other the opportunity to come in contact with a devotee and do service. And when they do service, they can understand the transcendental message. We don't have time, but briefly I'll say that there's a lot of concern amongst devotees these days about how will people understand Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam. Maybe it's a bit too much, you know. I mean, it's good for us, there's no doubt about that, but for the people in general, I mean, if you look at Prabhupada's prayer, Markine Bhagavad Dharma, three times in that poem he says, how will they understand? How? Three times! He's dealing with the issue right when he's about to get off the boat in the USA. He's totally cognizant of what's going on. How will these people ever understand? He says it three times. And then he gives the answer. Krishna, if you make my words potent, they'll understand. Krishna, you put them into Maya. You can bring them out of Maya. I desire that you deliver them. If they have your presence as Srimad Bhagavatam, they'll become purified. So it's a very interesting prayer to study from the viewpoint of how will anyone ever understand this? You see, Prabhupada himself grappling with that point. He openly says, why did you bring me to this terrible place? You must have some purpose, but these people can't understand anything. They're all covered by passion and ignorance, and they think themselves so content and satisfied in this forest of material enjoyment. How will they ever understand? And then you see the solutions he gives. Make my words potent, please. Make my words pure. Make your presence as Bhagavatam available to them. So this is nothing new. The whole issue about how will they understand goes right back to the founder Acharyas before he got off the boat in the USA. Three times in a short poem. Anything else? Yes.
Hare Krishna Maharaj, it's following on to, from the question Prabhuji just asked. Sometimes also we think that people who get frustrated in material life become jnanis. I was wondering if you could elaborate on that. Is this a correct understanding? How does someone become a jnani? Is it through frustration in material life? Because you said they don't become devotees straight away. They don't go directly to bhakti.
You become a speculator due to pride in your abilities. You think you're going to figure it all out. That pride that you're going to figure it all out produces volumes of books which further bewilder the general population. This Nobel Prize winner that I was talking about, he just openly said, you can't figure it out and don't worry about it. You're going to die. It's all absurd. You're going to become extinct. Just live your life your way. So he's a Kali Yuga Jnani. What does he have to offer? At least the Vedic Jnanis have the impersonal Brahman to offer. But what do the Kali Yuga Jnanis have to offer? So, someone becomes a jnani because of infatuation with their intellectual abilities. Your question reminds me. My freshman year at Yale University, I took a philosophy course, and the professor was very magnanimous. He announced that when you take the final exam of this course, you can ask for whatever grade you think you should get. So, wow, that's my kind of course. So, I sat down for the final exam, and the question was, what is virtue? And so I just wrote a long answer. What does it matter? Who cares? Everyone has their own idea of virtue. Everyone has their own conception. Why should you even ask a question like that? And for my answer, I deserve honors. He said, write what grade you want. I said, give me honors. I understand that it's all speculation. No one knows the real standard of what is virtue. How can you even ask a question like that? Well, he didn't give me honors, but he passed me. So I'm giving you that answer to show that it is possible to come to an intellectual understanding that no one knows what they're talking about, but then what do you do next? based on my own intuition that no one knows what they're talking about, I couldn't do anything about it until I met a devotee. And started reading Prabhupada's books. Yes.
Hare Krishna Maharaj, thank you for your class. You mentioned the point that Prabhupada said that every other endeavor besides devotional service is an illusion. Is it possible to stretch the concept of what devotional service is?
To what?
Like, you know, how do we know that, you know, I am engaging in devotional service? Because, for example, you know, just a very simple example, you know, someone may say, well, you know, eating prasadam is devotional service, but then they may eat so much prasadam. So, like, that's a simple example, but then there can be more complex ones. So how do I know I'm engaging in devotional service?
That's why you have spiritual guidance. The real way to take prasad is as service. You want to eat in such a way that encourages and nourishes your devotional service. But for new devotees like you, don't worry about it. Just take prasad, and gradually the finer realities will become known to you. Of course, overeating in India, you get an immediate reaction. But in any case, just take prasad.
It's just a simple example, but like there can be like other confusing things. You can be, you know, like, because, you know, we may have so many desires for devotional service, but like, you know, how can we focus our energy towards, you know, something particular?
Focus your energy toward what?
Towards like something particular. Like there's so many different devotional services that you can engage.
That's why we have devotional guidance. We find out what's the best way to serve Krishna. Just like, for example, whenever His Grace Vaisheshika Prabhu comes to Toronto, what do you hear? What do you hear? And why do you hear about book distribution?
As Prabhupada said, it's the
right.
It's very important.
So he is just representing Srila Prabhupada's desire. So that's what I mean about guidance. And then, of course, you hear it from others. You see Mangalarti Majiji's example. And you also have to cope with me. So in that way, you see what are the best ways to serve Krishna. All right. I thank you all very much. Hare Krishna, glory to Srila Prabhupada.
Hare Krishna, please get your mobile. Please get your mobiles. close this moment. Please get this.
Thank you.